Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Monday, May 8th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's show, we'll look at some legislation in Colorado that specifically affects Indigenous residents. Friday was a day of awareness about long-standing impunity in cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We'll hear interviews from a rally on the steps of the state capitol. And we'll look at what fuels chronic absenteeism in schools. After the BBC News headlines, we'll hear the latest commentary from Jim Hightower. Then comes Storytellers of Color. Today, host Rosana Longo-Better speaks with Raices Brewery founder Tamil Maldonado about what she calls the three C's: cerveza, comunidad, y cultura. At 9 a.m., it's Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Shauna Sprouls will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still coming up, but first the headlines with KGNU's Benita Lee.
Colorado Democrats introduced last-minute legislation over the weekend that would alter the payout terms of the 2023 Tabor refund. House Bill 1311, which passed along party lines on Sunday, would create a flat tax return rate rather than scale the refund based on income. One of the bill's sponsors told the Colorado Sun that presenting 1311 was put off until the property tax bill details had been finalized. Republican representatives expressed disapproval for the bill's sudden appearance on the schedule and whirlwind passage. Taxpayers will have the final say in the November ballot. If Proposition HH passes, single filers will receive a little more than $650, while joint filers will get around $1,300. Governor Jared Polis will consider two key bipartisan bills that would help compensate ranchers when wolves kill or injure their animals. Senate Bill 255 would establish a reimbursement fund for wolf attacks, but for that bill to be set in motion, Senate Bill 256 needs the governor's signature as well. Bill 256 would require that a so-called 10J rule be put in place before wolves are introduced to the Western Slope. The 10J rule is standard in other states with wolf reintroductions because it provides wildlife officials the ability to manage the wolf population, even though the wolves would be protected under the Endangered Species Act. Agricultural organizations want both bills in place. The complementary bills mirror the terms of Proposition 114, which Coloradans approved in the 2020 election. The House Judiciary Committee has rejected a bipartisan Senate bill that would have expanded punishment for drug dealers or anyone responsible for distributing illegal drugs to a person who then dies from an overdose of those drugs. Opponents say that while the overdose crisis needs to be addressed, drug-induced homicide laws don't work because they tend to punish the friends and families of victims instead of stopping the illegal drug trade. Lawmakers wanted to expand on a bill passed in 2022 that makes it a felony to provide someone with fentanyl that causes an overdose death. A TurboTax settlement will distribute about $2.7 million to eligible Colorado consumers. Attorney General Phil Weiser announced Colorado customers will receive distributions from a nationwide TurboTax settlement that was signed in 2020 by all 50 states and the District of Columbia. TurboTax is accused of deceiving over 89,000 Coloradans into paying to file taxes when they were eligible to receive a free service. Settlement checks will be mailed automatically through May 2023 without customers having to file a claim. Most people will receive about $30. The amount of each check will be calculated on the number of tax years customers qualify for. Six people were injured at a Marriott resort in Aurora Saturday when HVAC equipment collapsed into an indoor swimming pool area. In a press release, Aurora officials said between 50 and 100 guests were at the aquatic center when the accident occurred. The wounded hotel guests were transported to nearby hospitals, two with life-threatening injuries. Adams County is teaming up with Anythink Libraries to find its first poet laureate for a two-year residency. The poet laureate will present work at county events like the Anythink Concert Series. Applications are open until May 14th, any Colorado resident with a connection to Adams County is eligible for the position, which comes with a $40,000 stipend. Partly sunny today with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. In Boulder, a high near 73 and a low around 45. In Denver, a high near 76 and a low around 48. In Fort Collins, a high near 75 and a low around 44. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. The state legislature is in its final day of the session today, and a flurry of activity is underway. We'll be parsing through what did and did not make it through the legislative process this week, but today we'll examine bills that affect Indigenous people in the state. Last Thursday, Colorado Governor Jared Polis signed legislation enshrining the Indian Child Welfare Act into state law. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Adam Burke of KSUT and KSJD reports the legislation comes in response to a lawsuit that will be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court this summer.
In some respects, it's a pretty simple piece of state legislation.
It literally is one sentence long.
Jesse Danielson is a state senator from Wheat Ridge, Colorado, and one of the bill's primary sponsors.
Basically, it says that the state of Colorado will be protected by the Indian Child Welfare Act so that if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns it, then the state still has those basic protections.
The 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act prioritizes tribal identity in welfare cases involving Native American children. It gives legal standing to family members and to tribes in adoption cases. In 2017, a Texas couple challenged the law. Chad and Jennifer Brackeen, who are white, had been told they could not adopt a Navajo foster child after the Navajo Nation intervened. The Brackeens filed suit. This summer, the case known as Brackeen v. Holland reaches the U.S. Supreme Court on appeal. Senator Danielson says the new state law offers some temporary legal protection for Native American people in Colorado if the court strikes down all or part of the federal law.
Next legislative session begins in January of 2024. So if we need to take further action to work with whatever it is that the Supreme Court has come out with in their case, then we can address that in the coming legislative session.
Governor Jared Polis signed the bill into law at the state capitol yesterday. Southern Ute Tribal Chairman Melvin Baker attended the ceremony. According to reporting in Law Week, 10 other states have passed similar legislation. For KSUT and KSJD, I'm Adam Burke.
May 5th marks a National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, or MMIW. The date comes with Indigenous-led efforts to raise public awareness around high rates of violence committed against Indigenous women and girls, and the lack of prosecution or even adequate investigation of the crimes. On Friday, students from the American Indian Academy of Denver organized a rally on the steps of the state capitol. Among the speakers was Raven Payment of the Colorado MMIW Task Force.
We passed a Senate bill last year establishing an Office of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives. This office lives within the Colorado Department of Public Safety, and its sole focus is dedicated to addressing this crisis. And I'm going to call the director out right now, who I can see standing over there, Aaron Julian, with his hand up right now. And Director Julian's sole focus is working on these cases, working with your families. When a person goes missing, he's the one yelling at law enforcement to get the missing Indigenous persons alert out. We have a missing Indigenous persons alert system. We are only one of two other states that have this. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what your race is, what your gender binary is. It just matters that you're Indigenous. And this alert system goes out to all law enforcement and all media and anyone who signs up to subscribe to the email list. If you have not subscribed to that email list, do hit me up after. I will show you where to go to make sure that all of our communities are getting these alerts out. When we started this work a couple years ago in developing this task force, there were only 13 cases listed in the Colorado Bureau of Investigation's database for cold cases that were identified as indigenous. In 2 years' time, we have identified 84 additional cases. These are missing people, but a vast majority are unsolved homicides. 64% of unsolved homicides of Native people in Colorado reside within the Denver Police Department's jurisdiction. 98% lie within jurisdictions along the Front Range. Only 3 reside within tribal communities. So it is these urban metro areas that are really committing the most violence against our people. And I think we all know the statistic that 96 perpetrators of violence against Native people are non-Natives. So I'm standing before you today on the steps of this Capitol. As we're standing here right now, an additional provision for that Senate bill that we passed last year is supposed to be heard in the room right up here on this balcony. That's the House of Representatives chamber, and they'll currently be debating and voting on whether or not to pass this bill into law for the third time this session. When we walk, when we stand in front of this building, there's a whole rotunda of portraits of nothing but white men that enacted policies that tried to ensure that we would not be standing here having this conversation. And again, I'm going to look at my young people here that are standing here and be so proud that we are existing and that we are strong. And thanks to Renee's chant, we do know that we are going to fight back to ensure 7 generations from now we're still here. And I swear to God, we better not be having this conversation anymore, that this crisis will be finished. So I gave a bunch of dire statistics, which I hate talking about because they're awful and they're traumatic and they're violent. And my hope here going from today and with this office and with this work and screaming at law enforcement and our legislators to pay attention to us and start doing the right thing, that these statistics will go down and this crisis will end. And we won't have to be sitting out here on a beautiful day in Colorado parading our trauma around to plead for basic humanity. Miigwech.
That was Raven Payment of the Colorado Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force, speaking on the west steps of the Capitol Friday. Lawmakers in the House passed a bill Saturday to strengthen a recently created office focused on documenting and addressing disproportionate levels of violence targeting Indigenous people. Friday's rally at the Capitol was organized by students from the American Indian Academy of Denver, a 3-year-old public school serving grades 6 through 10. Terry Bissonette is the school's founder. She spoke with KGNU's Verity Matthews after the rally.
To be honest, I did not want the kids to do this rally. We started out doing a lot of research about missing and murdered Indigenous relatives and the national tragedy and crisis that it is. And our students became so passionate and so engaged with the research and all of the things that they were finding out that they wanted to come out to a public square, basically, and raise awareness about this issue. And so the school that we are, we're very responsive to our students and really encourage them to empower themselves, to be active, to be outside, you know, really demonstrating their passion and about, especially about issues that they care about, to show them that they can really engage and change their world now and not have to wait until they're an adult. And so when we had a group of high school students that really wanted to have a rally, really wanted to be on the west steps of the Capitol, speaking their truth and raising awareness about this issue, we made it happen for them and brought out our entire school, had community members support them, and it was a great day.
Who do you think most needs to hear and to understand why you guys are out here?
I think the general public and in general, because this is an issue that's been going on for decades. Our relatives go missing, or they're murdered by the thousands, and it's been going on for decades. And it's the tragedy is oftentimes those murders go unsolved. We are As Native people, we are the most policed people and also the most under-policed. On our homelands, we have at least 3 police agencies on all of our reservations, the FBI, tribal police, and also the BIA. Some of our reservations also have state and county police as well. But when one of our relatives goes missing or is found dead, those things often go unresolved. And so it's really, really important for the general public, as well as our elected officials and law enforcement, to understand that our children are watching, and they're understanding the realities that they're facing as Indigenous people and the realities that their relatives are facing as Indigenous people. And so it's very important for all of us as adults to respond to them and to let them know that that we matter. That Indigenous people matter, and that bringing justice to our people is very important.
The American Indian Academy of Denver is one of a handful of Denver public schools slated for closure. The school opened just before the COVID pandemic and has struggled to maintain a level of enrollment high enough to convince the school board to keep it open. Hather Brown is a parent of 2 students at the school, as well as a substitute teacher.
So American Indian Academy is just that. It's a school that's founded around Native American principles and moralities. We instill in our children to embrace their heritage wherever they come from. We have children from all different nationalities, all different colors and mixtures. So we teach them to really embrace who they are. We also have a earth-centered curriculum, so we teach our children to respect the earth, same way they would respect themselves, same way they would respect their relatives in their community.
The school is in danger of closing, or is closing?
The school is closing. We had a battle with DPS back in December to get funding to keep the school open. We convinced DPS that they had a moral obligation to keep these children in school until the end of the year. So they gave us funding from December to May. And in May, our doors will be closing without reopening next year. Yeah, unfortunately.
What does that mean to the students?
A lot of these students will be displaced to the schools that are in their neighborhood. But it's just really disheartening because we've really developed a family at the school. A lot of these kids have been going to the school for the 3 years that they've been open. They've all gotten to know each other, grow up with each other. So it's definitely going to be a big change for them, especially the younger kids who have been in there for 3 years. But we're hoping that we can have a strong community aftermath. And going into the new school year, that we can still be a support to the children.
Thanks to KGNU's Verity Matthews for sharing that audio from the rally around missing and murdered Indigenous women. On a different note about schools, students and teachers are in the final weeks of the school year, and many parents are encountering difficulties in keeping kids motivated in the final stretch. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke with Dr. Joshua Childs, a professor of educational leadership and policy.
I would offer this, and I want to maybe flip it around a bit, which is, what are schools and school districts not doing that makes kids not want to be engaged in school? So a lot of time and a lot of the conversation around student attendance is the onus is placed on the student themselves. They just don't want to be there. They are purposely missing. And I think we need to take a look in the mirror at what are we not doing that's not creating an environment that students want to come into regularly. Students feel connected. We know one of the leading indicators for students wanting to come to school regularly is that they know that there's a caring adult or caring adults in the building that know them and want them to be there. So what are we doing to foster community in a sense of culture that is welcoming for students? We also know that students are likely to be engaged in school when they see themselves in the curriculum. So are we providing ways in which students see themselves in the teaching and learning that's being provided in schools? And then I think the third thing that we should be thinking about is, how do we approach students, particularly now, I don't want to say post-pandemic, because there's a lot of variation around defining that, but like how should we be thinking of the purpose of schooling now in 2023, 3 years removed from the beginning of the pandemic? And so the ways in which families and students and communities engage with school is different now. And so it's not just a place of where I drop off kids and I expect them to be dumped, get a whole bunch of knowledge dumped on them. That no, schools are important fabrics of our community, our spaces that need to provide a variety of not only services, but engagements for students that prepares them for a world outside the four walls of the school building. And so, yeah, I think there is some truth to the fact that students, once they start missing, feel less engaged and don't feel a part of the school community. But I think we need to flip it in some ways and think about what can we be doing more to engage students, because I don't think that students go into the beginning of the school year saying, I'm going to purposely miss school for the whole entire school year and not attend.
Yeah.
You know, so we got to think about those of us that run and organize and research and create policies around schools. How do we make them more thriving and welcoming, engaging communities for students to want to attend more frequently?
Well, I wonder where the balance is between curriculum that can feel archaic and trying to get kids to want to come to school.
I think you've hit something very important, which is some of our curriculum is archaic. Students are attending schools across the country, across Colorado. Someone who got a master's from CU Boulder are attending schools that were designed for the 1800s, early 20th century. Rows and desks to sit quietly, to become, what's the word I'm looking for, standardized in how society functions and operates. And we know now, and we are engaged in conversations, we see the news, that you can learn anything outside of school. And not only can you learn, there are programs and algorithms that can do the learning for you and spit out that information. So now I think schools should be thinking innovatively, thinking of how do we prepare students for a life, not for post-secondary, not just for post-secondary education, but for a life outside of school that involves technology, AI, that involves engaging with a more global and connected community, right? And so I think we need to, the biggest buzzword of the last several years has been this reimagining of education. And a lot of people are using the word reimagining to do the same thing over again, but just make it more shiny. I would make the argument that reimagining means connecting with some of the more innovative technology tools that exist out there, to being open to having students engage with things like Wikipedia or social media and learning from those technologies and tools. How can students learn the processing of coding and constructing tools and methods that use critical thinking, computational thinking, right? And so I think that's important in thinking through what school looks like. And I think we have to have a reimagining of what is the purpose of schooling, right? And I think we're starting to see that's not just about getting students to go into very expensive four-year degree programs and then come out still unsure of what they want to do, right? When there's learning happening all the time that can happen typing into a computer or on your phone or on a tablet and so forth. So that's what I would say we need to have more of and more conversations around beyond just standardized testing in April.
Also, what about the actual curriculum? Like, for example, is it important for all high school students to read Edgar Allan Poe? Like, maybe we should be upgrading our curriculum.
So I think there is purpose to things like Edgar Allan Poe and some other things. Like, I think there's a purpose for it, but the way in which we go about teaching and building connections to it, right? So I saw this really cool, someone generated a story of Huckleberry Finn, and they created a whole kind of movie commercial using AI to tell a story of Huckleberry Finn. Like, right? Like, that was interesting intersection where you have this old classic novel and using current tools and technology to really engage a student into, like, oh, here I can tell a story of Huck Finn in 30 seconds using AI generated illustrations, right? Like, that was super fascinating. So I think there's ways in which we can connect the two to make it more engaging for students.
Is there anything I missed or that you would like to add?
I think when it comes to thinking about the ways in which to address chronic absenteeism, we have to move beyond just thinking about it as a school-related issue. It's a much larger ecosystem, community, neighborhood, city, regional issue. So we have to be thinking about the intersections of students attending school and transportation. If there's not safe transportation, reliable, consistent transportation beyond just school buses, but public transportation, students aren't going to attend regularly. If they're having to take care of their families, so what's the economic and job related factors that influence whether a student goes to school, right? So all of these outside of school indicators and factors that influence student attendance, I think it's important to think about, because oftentimes we think about school attendance and we place the blame, as I said earlier, on students or their families or, you know, parents about not caring, when in actuality, there's a whole list of reasons that have nothing to do directly with the students, but impacts the students in going to school. So I think we've got to begin thinking about the larger context when it comes to student attendance that we often don't talk about.
Dr. Joshua Childs is an assistant professor of educational leadership and policy at the University of Texas. Dr. Childs, thank you so much for talking with me.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's all for today's Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for the BBC.